Right, hold your horses. Before we jump into this week's episode, right, I just want to say a massive thank you to The Week Junior, who are sponsoring today's episode. Mm. A fantastic magazine that my kids absolutely love because it's like the latest news, but presented in a way that's really child-friendly.
Yeah.
Incredible stories from all around the world and mind-blowing facts. And I've got the best one to get us started.
It better be good because that was a build-up.
Oh, this one is quite something. But we're going to need some. We're going to need our editors to demonstrate this on the screen.
Right.
Right. Did you know that there are 7 octillion atoms in a human body? Right? All those little bits that make up a human body. There's 7 octillion, which is a 7 followed by 27 zeros.
No.
So, here it is.
I mean, you've put quite a task on our editors there.
Well, they can just do this.
Because if the editor, like me, is numerical and alphabet dyslexic...
Well...
Wow.
Yeah, there'll be a 1 in there.
It's wrong.
It's enough. But you have to visualise it, because that doesn't... I can't get that around my head. 7 octillion, 27 zeros. When you see it, you'll realise, like, oh, crikey, well, that's a billion... And then that's a trillion, and you're still going way, way after that.
No, because you know me and space. I can't get my head around it.
No. We'll go back and listen to our Professor Brian Cox episode.
Yes, very good episode.
There you go. You got a fact?
I've got a fact. I'm going to go... You know that I like animals, so I'm going to stick with the animal theme. Did you know that jellyfish poo out of their mouths? Dad fact. Poo, bum. And they don't have eyes... Or a heart.
Wow.
Yeah. But that kind of makes sense. When you see a jellyfish floating around the sea,
yeah,
doesn't look like it as much, does
yeah.
it?
It would be easier, life generally, if we also ate and pooed out our mouths.
Would it?
It'd be just easier, wouldn't it?
No. It's just really smelly.
No kissing.
No. Do you know what? Whilst I'm here, can I throw in an extra fact?
Please do.
Because we talked about jellyfish and hearts. Did you know that the octopus has 3 hearts and blue blood?
Mm. Oh, blue blood. That's going to send my GCSE textbooks haywire. Because you have deoxygenated blood and oxygenated blood and it all changes colours, red and blue. And yeah, octopuses, spanner in the works.
I've got quite a few animal facts thanks to Week Junior. Do you want one more?
Go on, hit me with one more.
Okay, how about this? Shark scales are made from the same material as the shark's teeth.
Wow.
Yeah, all this sort of stuff. And if your kids love animals, honestly, Week Junior has got some amazing facts about animals. I love animals. Everything to do with the natural world.
Yeah,
I read it for myself.
Yeah. Well, that is the thing, actually.
Forget the kids.
I had it at home, and after Ted had finished with it, / when he was still using it, I just started reading it.
Yeah.
Go to theweekjunior.co.uk/dadsnet-23 to get your 6 free issues. That link will also be in the description.
A Dadsnet original podcast.
Welcome back to the Dad's Net podcast. I'm Al. JK's not here because we've got an interview, and he's never here for interviews. This interview is amazing because we've all grown up with David Attenborough documentaries, whether it's been Blue Planet or Planet Earth 1, 2, and most recently Planet Earth 3. And today I'm super, super excited because... I have been able to spend half an hour speaking to the producers and directors of Planet Earth 3 and the stories that these guys share about how it was made, being on location for months and months and weeks in caves with no natural light at all. It's a truly inspirational story. You know, we all watch the documentaries and we all kind of look at that footage and go, bloody hell, how have they managed to capture such incredible shots of these animals? And they talk me through it. They share, like, the patience that they have. It's a really fascinating listen. So we hope that you enjoy this interview with the producers and directors of Planet Earth 3.
We have a lot of guests on the podcast, and I think that probably I am most envious of you two because of the experiences that you've been in producing Planet Earth 3. And I watch it with my kids and it's phenomenal. It's just fantastic. So, like, oh, maybe let's just go back to the beginning a little bit. Like, how did you end up producing Planet Earth 3?
So, yeah, you go.
Well, I mean, it started 5 years ago, which is an incredible amount of time to be making one television show. But it started 5 years ago, following on from Planet Earth 1 and 2. And, you know, never did we think we'd have a 2 year delay right in the middle of it because of COVID, but that set us back a couple of years. We started off making it. We were excited to get out in the field. We had it paused and then had to go do everything we planned to do in super quick double time. We had to film the whole of this Extremes episode that I worked on in basically a year, which when you normally have two and a half years to do it, it was somewhat exciting. And yeah, I mean, you know, it's following on from those two mega series. So there's a lot of pressure to get it right. And in a short amount of time as well, it's, yeah, we're proud of what we've done though. I think it's a great series.
Hugely proud, but to your point, it's a great opportunity and a great privilege. And those first two series inspired us all to want to make natural history programs. And then to end up in the last 5 years making something that's so extraordinary has been a real privilege.
Yeah. And like they go down, don't they, these programs as, I mean, I think they're iconic. I think that they're part of the very, very best television that's available out there, bearing in mind there's an awful lot of television out there. Because never in normal life do you get to see what you guys have filmed and shot and put together for us. What's that like to be able to see those things in real life? I mean, I suppose you're thinking of the job at the same time as experiencing the most incredible things.
I think, don't know what you think, Theo, but I think you've got to split those two things in two, because on the one hand, it's absolutely terrifying when you're faced with a series like this, because you're trying to raise the bar. And that is a pretty hard job when you look at what's come previous to that. But once things are going right, it's extraordinary. When you get on location, although you've maybe been on some slightly more difficult location yeah. shoots than me, it's extraordinary. The panic at the beginning, the angst when you get out on location, you've done all this research, you've worked with all these people, and you've got the weight of expectation on your shoulders. So, I mean, it's almost like Sir David's there kind of looking at you saying, you better get this right. Once you get a couple of those first shots in the can, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
But I think, you know, the reason why we do it, all of us, I think, is to be out there witnessing those things and to tell the stories of wildlife out there. You know, that's what we want to do. That's what we love doing. And that's how we get excited. And yeah, it is hard. It is, you know, very boring sometimes. You've got to be an eternal optimist to film the things that we do, because every day you've got to wake up thinking the thing that is unlikely to happen is going to happen. And then, you know, inevitably, well, most of the time anyway, it does happen. And you're like, yes, yes, all that work paid off, all that research. But that's why we do it. You know, we love the natural world and want to tell stories about it.
We also want to see really different things. I mean, Theo, if you don't mind me saying, you know, one of our shoots, one of the shoots that Theo kind of dreamt up was to go to this place in this cave in Vietnam. It's known to be the world's biggest cave. But to get there, you've got to take 500 kilos of equipment on foot for 2 days through the jungle. And then he lived underground for 18 days, longer than anyone has spent in that cave. So the results are spectacular. But even to put yourself in that situation, you really want to see new things, experience new things and show them in a new way.
Yeah, I mean it sounds incredible. What do you think, where is the most extreme places that you filmed? Because obviously the latest episode coming, well, at the time of filming, it's coming out on Sunday. I think by the time this airs, it will be out. Is called Extremes. What's the most extreme location that you were on?
Oh, that's a tricky question. I think there's a lot to be said about camping in the Arctic, which is pretty extreme. I mean, you know, camping in Cornwall is one thing. You know, it's sort of like second level fun, isn't it? You've got all your stuff, everyone's enjoying it, but at the base of it, you know, it's a logistical exercise. You do that in the Arctic, and you remove the fun part of that, And it's just logistics. You've got to take everything you need. You've got to take all your food for 2.5 months. You've got to have tents that sort of are meant to withstand snow, wind, everything. But then when they don't, they get blown, you know, a mile away on the tundra. You know, all your items and personal things are scattered across the tundra. You've got to go and collect it. You've then got to find somewhere to wash, which you don't, because there's no water really to do that, and it's freezing cold. The toilet is a ply box, a box of, you know, made of ply, that is just sat on the tundra. There's no shield, there's no nothing. So, you know, you're getting battered by blizzards or wind or sun, maybe once a year. You know, and you know, there's, and then you've got wolves, right? You've got wolves running around. They're pinging guy ropes off of your tents. They are just super inquisitive, these wolves. They're super habituated. They'll come right up to you and explore that. They'll take, we had a scientist there working with us for a week or so, and they took her Wellington boot, shredded that. You know, that probably has to be the most extreme. And you'd think actually living inside a cave deep underground in perpetual darkness would be as extreme as you get. But actually, I think you'd probably go the Arctic over the cave.
Add to everything that Theo said, add COVID to that mix, which meant that the one place where you could sleep on the island that was inside, they weren't allowed to go into. And yeah, then the wolves that they were filming travel 50 kilometres.
50 miles a day.
And you have to, they had to kind of move that 50 miles. You were on kind of small 4x4 quad bike type things, but they get stuck in the mud. I've heard one story at least of Theo going out and someone forgetting the shovel, getting stuck in the mud,
yeah,
having to dig it out by hand. It's quite a, and then having to, actually, in the end, dig an airstrip.
Yeah, we had to clear a runway, you know, as you do. It's all in the day. So, yeah. I mean, you know, talk about things you don't plan to do or ever get trained to do. You know, I did a degree in zoology and that was great. And I love the animals and that's why I do my job. Definitely didn't do a degree in runway clearance or anything like that. I mean, the things that you have to do for this job are insane sometimes.
Yeah, I guess you don't realise. I mean, when we sit on Sunday night and we watch the show and we think that's amazing, we've got no comprehension of everything that's gone before to get that shot. I think, wasn't there one, was it the elephants possibly, if I remember correctly from the notes, but you were filming for about 450 hours to get the right shot. Is that something like that?
Yeah, was it?
So many. I mean, that's like the story of almost every sequence. Yeah. There's one sequence that comes to mind, the mugger crocodile sequence, where it took six different shoots, delayed, some of them delayed, to get 3 years to actually get the shot that we needed. On the last part, we were delayed because of COVID, we were delayed because there was political strife, and we were delayed because the weather doesn't play ball these days. It's obviously changed markedly. And then when they finally did get there, the cameraman had to spend 300 hours sat in a hide, just in a hide. And when we talk about hide, it's like sitting in a phone box kind of thing. 300 hours. For the first 100 hours, nothing happened whatsoever. Baking hot sun. What we were trying to, the crocodiles we were trying to film and the prey animals that come close to them, as soon as he opened a water bottle, it would frighten the prey animals off. And for the last 200 hours, he had to really keep on it, really, really keep watching. And he taught himself to sleep in 5-second microbursts, apparently. I mean, none of us can work out how that works, but it definitely did work because he got the shot.
Wow. Well, I mean, every parent needs to learn that.
Exactly.
That's a game changer. If you can do that. Fantastic.
You're laughing.
No, I think it's incredible how, you know, this huge amount of effort. Like, what happens if you just don't get the shot? Do you just simply wait and keep trying until you get something?
Well, basically, yeah. I mean, you wait. The real skill, I mean, Theo's letting me answer this because I think he wants me to blow sunshine. The real skill of a producer on location is being able to recognise when a story is going to happen, when it's not going to happen, how you might be able to change that story. So obviously we've spent a huge amount of time and effort getting to a place, and sometimes it doesn't pay off, you know, but we like to say that nature writes the greatest scripts, and often you do then come across something that is that you just hadn't expected. So the real skill of a producer like Theo is being on the ground and changing the story when he's there, if necessary. So you do get something that you come back with. It's very, I mean, over the course of 5 years, there are very, very few stories that didn't come to fruition.
I think it's all about like risk. When you go out on these shoots, you've got, you know, something you desperately, desperately want to get, which is, you know, your general story. And parts of that story are like really rare. Sometimes they happen, sometimes they don't. You want it all to happen, but some of it, sometimes it doesn't. We had a team out filming snow leopards in Mongolia, and snow leopards are notoriously hard to film. But, you know, as a planet Earth staple animal, I was like, we've got to have these snow leopards in the episode. So we'd set out camera traps for 8,000 hours, right? 24 camera traps for over a couple of years out in Mongolia in the Gobi Desert, right? It's one of the hottest, one of the coldest places in the world. It's, you know, an extraordinary place. And these snow leopards, obviously, super elusive animals. And we'd never really been able to film cubs in a really close up and intimate way. And we were using these camera traps to do it. But also what I wanted to do was try and film snow leopards with a drone as well, because it's rarely been done before. And, you know, the scientists are like, you're crazy. Don't even bother. You know, we spend months out here every year. We don't see them. And so anyway, I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. Let's give it a go. And like, you know, the director was ringing me up or WhatsApping me. And she was like, oh yeah, the animals, I mean, we're not seeing anything. We're just seeing ibex, right? We're just seeing goats. And I was like, keep at it. You know, you've got to be optimistic. Keep going. She's like, yeah, whatever. And anyway, she messaged me one day and going, yeah, we filmed some snow leopards. I'm like, what? That's amazing. She sent me a clip through, and it was like something out of The Lion King. It was the most amazing images of a mom and cubs walking along a ridgeline at sunset. And the drone is flying actually away from the pilot. It's about 3 kilometers away. It's freezing cold. And to use these drones, it's super fine motor control, right? So it's pointless wearing big gloves. You got to take your gloves off. So he was there, bare hands, minus temperatures, freezing his little fingers off. And he knows he's only got one shot at this, because the scientist standing there going, you're never going to see this again. I've never seen it. No one will ever film this again. You know, this is truly once in a lifetime moment. And he's got a battery life of about 40 minutes and he's flying there. He's like, you know, the wind is howling over this ridgeline, and he honestly gets some of the most amazing shots of snow leopards I think they've ever been filmed. It's remarkable. And what it does for the episode is it sums up this feeling of, yeah, the extremes are a hostile place, but species have evolved over millions of years to live in them, right? They are super well adapted. But actually, you know, as much as there are these wilderness places and there is hope in the natural world that there are these places still existing, our world is also changing and it's becoming more extreme. And I think that's the essence of the episode.
But also what that speaks to, and what we're talking about, that drone flight, it's a feat of excellence. And sometimes when you do get onto these situations, you only have one shot, and then to come away with what is one of the most beautiful shots of snow leopards, or probably the most beautiful shots of snow leopards you will ever see, is kind of what planet Earth is about. It's putting yourself right at the limits of what you're pushing yourself right to the limits of what you can actually achieve. That's how the bar keeps getting higher and higher.
I've got a couple of questions that are more, well, you're both dads, I believe, at least. And I'd like to ask, firstly, how your job impacts the way that you were parents, because this is a completely different thing. I mean, we talk about extreme, and parenting is quite extreme in a lot of cases, but that kind of optimism and persistence that you have to have in huge amounts when you are putting together planet Earth. Do you feel like sometimes you come back and go, oh, think that's quite easy in comparison to that. Or do you take those traits that you need to have and those skills for planet Earth and kind of think, oh, I'll use that when my child will not go to sleep or whatever it is? How do the two things speak to each other?
I mean, I've only been doing this 11 months, so right, so I'm relatively new in the dad scheme of things. But all I can say, and to the massive irritation of my partner, I think being a dad is very much like being on a shoot. You know, it's a sleep deprivation. There's boredom. There's like massive highlights, and then there's huge lowlights too. And you know, you're on this kind of oscillating graph of highs and lows, and everything in between. But yeah, it's actually very like a shoot. I reckon if you're a dad, you can do a shoot. Yeah, no problem.
I think you're probably right. You can it's definitely that way around, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you can be a dad, you can definitely go on one of these shoots. And a lot of it is about having not unbridled optimism, but being absolutely just loving to face a challenge. It's really that moment when you're giving a baby and you walk out of hospital and you've never, I mean, you haven't even carried the thing for 9 months that your partner has had, and you've just handed this beautiful thing that you love so much, but you've got no idea what to do with it. I mean, I don't know about you, but they hadn't even taught me how to put him into the car seat.
Yeah, yeah.
I had no idea how to do that.
No.
Yeah, much harder than being on a shoot. I'll give you that. I'll do 18 days underground anytime.
Yeah.
Yeah, in comparison, yeah, living in a cave. And I guess, like, also, I'd like to ask what moments you've seen and what moments have you witnessed of fatherhood in the wild in terms of the animals. And I was asked, or I was, it was suggested that I ask about the jacana. Is that how you say it? Or jacana?
Jacanas, yeah. Jacanas, they're also called lily trotters, and it's pretty extraordinary, that story, actually. So, and in fact, there are, across the series, there are some real super dads, but this jacana is extraordinary. So jacana males parent as single parents, and they live on the floods of the Okavango, so in Botswana and Namibia, and they live on lily pads, so on top of the water, but they've got aerial predators, and they've got predators from underneath in the form of crocodiles, and they've got these really precocious kids. As soon as they come out of the egg, they're ready to go wandering and explore, and they can eat as soon as they come out. They've got feet that I think they're about twice the size of the chick when they come out. Yeah. So they're huge. So they're kind of quite klutzy, and they're always falling over and falling into the water. And this super dad teaches them how to be a lily trotter. At the same time, he's trying to keep them alive. And when danger is near, he lets out a shriek and a special call. Well, I guess it is a shriek, because that's exactly, it's like your kids when they step onto the edge of the road, you kind of calls and they've got to freeze. And that's the one thing they've got to do. I've never seen this behavior before, but in the sequence, this proper super dad then went off to try and distract a crocodile, to take him away from the chicks. And I mean, that is bravery beyond, right?
Yeah.
When he comes back, he manages to find three of his chicks. He calls them, they come back, and they come back over to him, but one of them's missing, and he has to go off and find them. And it is like, it's one of the most nail biting, heartfelt moments in the whole series. If you haven't watched it, watch it. If you have, watch it already. You know what the ending is, so I don't need to tell you. But unless you want me to tell you.
No, let's save it for listeners who haven't seen it yet.
One of the other extraordinary things they do, what's the other extraordinary thing that he does, how he carries them around?
Oh, this is like a test.
It is, don't you remember? Have you watched it?
Oh, yeah, when he tucks them up under their wings.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is cool. Actually, it's one of those shots, isn't it, where he stands up and his chicks fall out from underneath his wings, it says.
Yeah. Kind of, he picks them up underneath the wings and carries them around. So you kind of got this weird alien-like thing. You've got a bird, this bird with really long legs and massive feet walking around with loads of legs hanging out from underneath its wings.
Wow. It's just incredible, like, when you see these things on the screen or you guys in real life. And is it humbling to think that when everything boils down to kind of basics, your job as dad, kind of the same as the Jagan, like protect, teach at the same time how to navigate this ridiculous world that our kids are growing up about. It must be humbling to think when it all boils down, when you lose all the glitz and the glam and the tech and the whatever else, it's kind of the same principle as what you're witnessing in front of you.
Yeah, it is. It is humbling. I remember the first shoot I ever did internationally was in Uganda following some chimpanzees. And a moment I'll never forget. I definitely wasn't a dad at this point. I was way young. And this little chimpanzee baby, I'm not sure, probably around 1-2 years old, so tiny, but playful. And it was up in a tree, and I was like, oh, let's see if I can play hide and seek with it. And so I'd come out from behind the tree and look at it, and it would copy me. And it was truly amazing. I mean, like that's one of those moments where you realize chimpanzees, humans, you know, basically the same. And I think that speaks to your point of like how humbling it is and how similar it is. You know, I think we are not far removed from the natural world when you strip out everything. And those chimpanzees, yeah, I've been thinking about them a lot recently as I've been playing quite a few hours of peekaboo.
Probably far more obedient than your child will ever be, I imagine.
Oh, 100%.
100%. But it is, but to that humbling point, it's incredible to watch how any parents, and when you are down, you're in that kind of place, you've been sitting in a hide for however long you've been sat in it, you're watching all of this happen, and actually every single thing that they do is something that you really aspire to do. To run around, to run around like a Jacana. I mean, he's all over the place looking after those. They're bomb burst in the world's most dangerous place. And then he keeps them all together. It is extraordinarily humbling.
Do you think as well, I don't want to read, well, maybe this isn't reading too much into it, but do you think actually sometimes we could learn a lot from observing parenting in the natural world?
I mean, we could probably all learn quite a lot from observing any dads. That's quite, can we?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, that's difficult to say that I'm sure there are some crap dads in the natural world as well, but they, I'm sure we could, more than anything else, probably just spending that bit of time. It's really hard work when you're on location, but you do have a lot of time to yourself and you do have a lot of time to actually, kind of meditate in a strange way, don't you? And that's got to be a pretty good thing.
Mm. I think another great dad story from the series is the ostrich. So that's in the Deserts and Grasslands episode, and that's an amazing situation where the dad has to do basically most of the sort of childcare and sort of nesting behavior. So looking after the chicks as at the nest whilst they're emerging, and the emergence happens over days, right? So he's there, stuck there for ages. He gets, you know, a little bit time to go off and eat, but largely he takes the night shift. He's doing all those things that we're all familiar with. And it's just an amazing story to see them all hatch, but then one of these eggs is left unhatched. He has to go. He can't sit there forever with these chicks that are like going all over the place. So he makes the decision to leave, leaving this one unhatched egg. And again, I'm going to spoil it for people, but that is a moment to watch because that's a great natural world dad story.
The reason he has to leave, just which is quite important, is that they decide to nest in the middle of the hottest desert in the world. And the reason they do that is that fewer predators come out. So hence the fact that they have to get the chicks, or he has to get the chicks off the plains and into the shade at some point.
It's just, honestly, it's remarkable. We, you know, me and my wife and we sit the kids down and we watch it. And every time we watch it, we're just amazed. What, I don't know if this is a difficult question or whether you get asked it a lot, but what is the one standout moment of hundreds of moments that are obviously incredible. Which is the one that you think I will never forget, that particular moment, and why?
That is such a difficult question.
Well, it's very, very difficult for Matt because he's sitting next to me and obviously he has to say something in the extremes episode. But for me, obviously, in the extremes episode, I think it's probably the moment when we were underground. So this cave is called Han Song Dong in Vietnam, one of the biggest caves in the world. It's 5 miles long, a couple of hundred meters high in some places, and huge. You know, you could fly a jumbo jet through it. It's massive. And there are these points in the cave where the roof has collapsed. And what it does is it allows these, you know, light to flood in, right? And these forests grow like 200 meters underground. It's insane. Absolutely amazing. But what it also does is when the earth's tilt aligns with the sun at certain points of the certain times of the year, just a few weeks a year, in fact, you get these sunbeams, these God rays flooding down into the cave. And they reach further because of the angle, they reach further down into the cave than usual. And we wanted to film this, and that's sort of why we went in this time period. And obviously in the film, it looks stunning, but to be there and witness that after days spent in the darkness was like, all right, I get it now. I get why this sun thing's so important. You know, it was just like so bright. When we were trying to film the cave with our like tiny little lights and, I know, but lighting a few hundred meters at a time, the sun comes in and, you know, the whole thing is lit up. And there's this warmth and glow that comes from it. It was genuinely emotional watching it. It was truly astonishing. And then when we came out of the cave a few days later and we sensed the world outside the cave, you know, it was like so green. It was so vivid. The smell was like nothing you'd ever experienced before. It was like an assault on the senses. So for me, both experiencing that and actually in the film itself, that is a massive highlight. Never forget that.
Yeah, no, sounds spectacular.
There's a beautiful bit it's a beautiful bit of the film, but it's also a beautiful bit in the making of Extremes that speaks to that point. And for me, it's a really, as Theo said, it's a difficult question, and it is a bit like being asked to choose your favourite child. It's there are lots of brilliant, brilliant sequences, moments across the series, and I think each one has its standout moment. For me, in the Extremes episode, it might be the fragility of those beautiful butterflies, the monarch butterflies in Mexico, and they go on this long migration, and then they hibernate in this woodland in the mountains of Mexico to kind of sit out the winter, as it were. But when that's fine, when they huddle together for warmth, it's totally amazing. But if an extreme event comes through, a big storm or something, they all get blown out of the canopy. It's not really the canopy, is it? But they get blown out of the tree. And they land on the floor, and on the floor it is freezing. And you've got these incredibly fragile creatures on the floor that would freeze to death if they can't climb back up. It's much too cold for them to fly, and they have to climb back up the tree trunk. And we follow one journey, and then at the end of it, we see them all take off as the sun comes out. And it is just the most kind of awe-inspiringly, spine-tinglingly beautiful moment. Mm. This show is absolutely filled with beauty.
Yeah. It sounds just incredible. Last question, and then we'll wrap up. But when you take that level of inspiration that you have had because of what you've been experiencing and seeing on shoots and in the making of Planet Earth, how do you move that into trying to inspire your kids, like without taking them there, which maybe one day you'll have the opportunity to do, but how do you try to think, right, I've been inspired by these most incredible things that I've seen, how do you then try and deliver that to your kids to inspire them, or will for you, Theo?
For me, it's about finding beauty in as much as you possibly can. There's beauty in everything. You don't have to go to Vietnam or Namibia or the Gobi Desert to see these wonderful things. They're right on your doorstep. And one of the, in this series itself, one of my highlights was filming in Kent, actually, and seeing all the butterflies and listening to the birds. And partly it was because David Attenborough was there, I'll admit, but it was an awe-inspiring moment. The sun came out, it'd been raining for days around it. It was just thoroughly beautiful. And so with my kids, that's why I try and inspire. That's what we talk about. There is beauty in everything. And obviously then it frustrates me sometimes that they find more beauty sometimes in their laptop or their phone than they do in what's outside. But when they do actually get outside, and when we do get to the seaside or for a walk in the hills, it's just a beautiful moment. In fact, we went away a couple of weekends ago and went to stay in a little kind of, it's like a bunkhouse in Wales. And the kids turned around at one point and said, "Why was it when you were really little that you always used to drag us on walks? And now we would love to go and see what's out there. You never take us." And it's just that this kind of delightful moment that you suddenly think, you know what, I may have thought I'd said too much, but it seeps in. There's great inquisitiveness from children. They want to get out and they want to see things.
I think it's possibly even more than that. I think in more grown up children, I think there's that inquisitiveness for sure. But certainly for my 11 month old, you know, like up to this point, you take him outside and he will calm down immediately. Like it's really, really noticeable. I'm sure not every child is like this, but for him, it's the power of being outside. I don't know what it is. It's not like, you know, I don't live in a national park. I just live in Bristol. Take him outside and it's the air, it's the sound. I don't know what it is, but it just calms him down and it's amazing how much it resets. And I think that has been a real observation that I think I will take forward and try and use that in a way that can kind of help him adjust to the world, right? Just to kind of relax and to slow down sometimes and trying to get that pace right of life, because I think that's the most important thing. I think that's the thing we've all lost, right? Is that, you know, we all live like a super fast life. It's all in our pockets. It's all in our phones. It's all in our face. But slowing down with nature, that is something I'd love to be able to teach.
Yeah. Well, I think there's probably not many people better positioned to teach him those skills than yourself. Gents, it's been brilliant. I feel like I could ask you hundreds and hundreds of questions for the rest of the day and probably the rest of the week. But we'll have to wrap it there. Thank you so much, firstly on a personal level, for just producing such an incredible show. I haven't watched all 5 episodes that didn't come out yet, but we're catching up. And I'm looking forward to Extremes on Sunday. So thank you for producing such a wonderful show. And secondly, thank you for your time today.
No worries, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Dan.
Okay, great pleasure, and thank you very much for inviting us.
A Dad's Net original podcast.